Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly attempt to inject libertarian analysis into the statist news cycle. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy National School Choice Week, my fellow backpack funding enthusiasts.
Present.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Just a warning at the top that my voice is a little bit bad. Sorry about that. And Catherine is flying on Percocet. She has no idea what her name is, how to pronounce it, or anything else. So just keep that in mind. We're going to try to torture her as much as possible. Is that right, Catherine? You didn't want me to mention that, right?
Yeah, when I told you that, I was hoping you would say it at the top of the podcast.
Yeah, that's good. All right. We're going to get to some of that juicy school choice stuff later in the podcast. But first, let's talk about a scoop late last week from Reason's own Robbie Suave, if that is his real name, under the headline, "Inside the Facebook Files, Emails Reveal the CDC's Role in Silencing COVID-19 Dissent." The piece was brought out the same day that we posted our March issue cover story. This is the miracle of long magazine lead times, people, in case you're wondering about the dates. That was also by Robbie on how the CDC became the speech police. Documents obtained by Mr. Suave from the state of Missouri's lawsuit against the Biden administration show that the CDC kept tabs on Facebook's moderation practices and regularly told the company what the agency wanted it to do, such as suppress posts that asserted COVID-19 leaked from a Chinese laboratory, throttle content suggesting that vaccines may do more harm than good among certain populations, and indeed flag anything that, quote, could potentially cause vaccine refusal. Catherine, if you can respond to this, we're going to get into various interpretations of what this reporting does or does not mean. But just to kick us off, editor in chief, can you tell us what we have learned and why it's important?
Sure. They'll take home lessons, as the kids say. So this is a piece actually that started as sort of a top level idea assignment. We basically said, listen, increasingly in these debates about the kind of policing of speech on social media, there's a blurring of the line between government power, bullying, what is called jawboning by some like enterprising think tankers who want to make that a thing, and then just free association. And this is, you know, for those of us who really valued the distinction between public and private and want to make it as bright a line as possible, this has been kind of a challenging moment. And so the initial assignment to Robbie was like, listen, just talk to some people about this and do a feature story that's kind of big thinky. But as he started working on this story, it became clear that it was really more of an investigative piece. It's important to know what is actually happening within these companies before we can adjudicate what should happen or where kind of the demands of the Constitution rest. And Robbie got a hold of these documents actually pre-Twitter files. So it ended up being kind of a moment where we were seeing a lot of very, very similar stuff trickling out in the most annoying format known to man, a broken Twitter thread, and then another broken Twitter thread, and then like 50 more broken Twitter threads. But, you know, for me, these documents were challenging because there is no smoking gun. These don't have smoking guns in them. It is not a moment where the CDC says, if you don't do this, we will put you in jail. It's subtler, it's softer, and it's, for the most part, willing. In my editor's note for the same issue, I say that, you know, they're happy. They're clearly happy to do this, and maybe would have done it even without the CDC's urging. And so that, again, puts us in a tricky position about where the boundaries are of free speech. But I think it is clear that, you know, when we have the president saying social media companies are killing people, there is an implied threat. And so that's really worth exploring. And that's what this piece does.
Nick, there's been reaction both to our Facebook files reporting and the Twitter files in general that go along the lines of like, look, it's a pandemic. People are dying. So what's wrong with private companies seeking the expertise, the consultation from well-informed government bodies about how not to become cesspits of denialism and other types of misinformation?
Yeah, No, and you know, a lot of when you look at the emails, there's also an hour and a half long discussion that Zach Weismuller and I did with Robbie last week's Reason live stream. You can go to reason.com and our videos vertical, our YouTube channel, Reason TV, and listen to that. The people at Facebook were absolutely going out of their way to saying, what about this? What about this? Like, you know, and they were looking for guidance. And it makes a certain amount of sense to go to the government agency that is charged with, you know, actually coming up with the best policy for this type of stuff and to be a clearinghouse for the best information to do that. You know, on some level, that's responsible. Where things get complicated, to build on what Catherine was talking about, is first, the CDC has been a terrible broker of information, particularly because they don't really acknowledge the limits of their own knowledge at any given point in time. That was especially true during COVID, where, you know, not even as much on information, but on things like testing protocols and whatnot, they, you know, they acted very poorly and they never really explained the limits of their knowledge. So that's a big problem, that you're relying on an, you know, an expert agency that turned out to be really bad at it. And then on top of that, the lack of transparency in all of this, I think, is as important, if not more important, with readers. Because the fact of the matter is, it's one thing if social media platforms, and this is completely separate from the question of whether or not they have the right to do this, but when they de-amplify or, you know, throttle the reach of certain types of information or ban people or shadow ban in the case of Twitter and things like that, without kind of acknowledging it, that is, I think, kind of unforgivable from a social media point of view. Like, you know, nobody, you know, like when restaurants serve certain types of meat, but not other kinds of meat, or they refuse to do, you know, serve something, they kind of talk about it, they promote it. Part of the problem, and I think part of the loss of faith in social media, is that we don't know what's going into their decision-making apparatus, and then they lie about it after the fact. And that's a big issue right here.
I would add to the CDC mishandling of information, Rochelle Walensky, the director, repeatedly just misciting and drawing the wrong conclusions from any number of studies having to do, especially in school settings, masking in school settings. Jacob Sullum has written repeatedly about this. But when you can see right there the machinery working in such a way where they're trying to maximally bolster their outcome of how they want your behavior to be shaped by misstating, to the point where the researchers who did the original studies are like, stop it, then that has a deleterious effect. Peter, building on that, a lot of this activity from the Biden administration comes from July 2021, when Surgeon General Vivek Murthy did his announced that he's going to do a whole of government, you know, confront health misinformation task force or movement. You had the White House press spokesman Jen Psaki at the time warning that Facebook needs to move more quickly to remove harmful posts. And she was even like pressuring Spotify to do something about Joe Rogan. And then, of course, as Catherine mentioned, President Biden infamously said that social media is killing people. A lot of this activity took place then. A lot of the social media companies banning people took place then. I'm going to ask you to table the free speech argument for a moment. Put that aside and put on your public health and health policy hat. From a health policy point of view, both for COVID and future public health pandemic, especially crises, what is wrong with that particular approach?
Well, one thing that's notable is that much of this, the timeline that you're pointing out here, is all after the vaccine was available and after people could make choices for themselves about whether or not they were going to get vaccinated and what they were going to do with their lives. And so that was the point to me at which it was pretty clear that there was no longer like a real debate to be had about what we should do in terms of COVID policy and pandemic response. And I still think that there are some legitimate arguments to be had about what we should have done in March through of 2020 through early 2021 when the vaccine was not available to most people. But once the vaccine was available to most people, which is sometime around April, May, June of 2021, right? That cluster of months, depending on exactly who you are and exactly where you live. That, to me, like, is the point at which the government should have said, here's the vaccine. Here's the evidence for why we think it's good and why it works, right? Like, this is why it's good for you. You should take it. Run ads if they want people to take it. And then that should have been that. And what's notable is that all of this stuff happened afterwards, yeah. In part because, you know, some of the original claims about the vaccine did turn out to be overblown, right? The vaccine was not able to quickly adapt to some of the variations, the Omicron, you know, that sort of thing, if you remember that. And so the reopening that people had expected with the vaccine coming online, you know, sort of we kind of reopened. And then especially in blue states and blue cities, we didn't for the second half of 2021. There were still mask requirements. There were still, in some cases, you know, sort of limitations on stuff that people could do. And I think that was the period where the most obvious mistakes in retrospect were made.
Catherine, I'm going to invite you to challenge your Percocet-addled brain. We talk a lot on this podcast and at Reason about Section 230, about the distinction between platform and publishing, or the alleged distinctions and that kind of thing. And we argue constantly on the side of people who publish on the internet should not be held liable for their commenters and such like. That approach, I would argue, turns a lot of websites and social media are classic of this to become essentially third party platforms, right? So the analogy I would like you to reflect on is it not the case that some of the worst bits of third party, of worst bits of government overreach, federal law enforcement overreach, I don't know, gag orders on people to talk about investigations of their commenters happen right there in the third party things? It's when the feds say, look, national security is making us want to crack down on bank accounts, and they go there. If that's the case, is there a useful analogy to be drawn, including in such a way to try to win over skeptics who think this is a nothing burger, that the social media companies are out there trying to figure out misinformation? When governments find that third party person to lean on, the government leans on the third parties in a way that is contrary to the spirit of the Constitution. Yes? No?
I mean, I think that, like, that portrait of the world that you just painted is why there are so many people who are libertarians or libertarian adjacent who are so hyped about crypto and blockchain, right? I mean, that's like, that feels like the place where the answer will be. Now, maybe that's wrong in the end, right? But even when you think about the power of these third parties that you're describing, there are still many, many, many more nodes, many, many more paths to get information from point A to point B than there were pre-internet. And I think that's the thing that people kind of are a little bit ahistorical about, or kind of historically illiterate about when we're complaining about this. Like, it used to be that if the government didn't want something published, they only had to go beat up a couple of guys. You know, they only had to go be like lightly menacing at the club to a couple of guys. And I think that this same dynamic has always happened. Like, jawboning is not new. It is being practiced differently right now. And so we're thinking through, well, you know, what is the remedy? And you know, I think it's easy to forget. We have to keep fighting these battles in the courts and everywhere about what the limits are of prior restraint, about what the limits are of kind of government using third parties to throttle speech directly or indirectly. We didn't like invent this with the pandemic. We didn't invent this with Facebook. We didn't invent this with Hunter Biden's stupid laptop. And so I think like it's important context. I also think that there's, you know, there will always be choke points, and that, you know, the fact that we are having this conversation broadly reminds us that even if Facebook or Twitter or whoever had taken a really aggressive approach, you know, even if Twitter had said, anybody who writes the words lab leak is off our platform permanently, that would not, in fact, have stopped people from thinking and knowing and talking about the lab leak theory. And I think that's, you know, this is where you get into this kind of like public square, public utility kind of messy argument that people want to make around the Section 230 debate, which I think is pretty misguided. I just don't think that's the right framework, because we have a public square and it's not any one platform. It's bigger, broader, much harder to regulate. Thank God.
It might actually be useful to just provide a little bit of background on job owning, since that came from the 1960s and 1970s when Presidents Lyndon B. Johnson and Richard Nixon used what was then termed job owning, and that was a sort of novel term back then, to try to argue companies into reducing prices as a way of combating inflation. And so this was right. So in 1969, I just wrote about this in the magazine a few months ago. In 1969, Time described job owning as White House pressure on specific industries against specific price increases. And that was like that was the maneuver that they had, that they felt like they could use to try to fight inflation, because they were just going to say, well, for the good of the country, you can't raise prices, even though all the prices on their inputs for these companies were going up. And then, of course, it didn't work very well.
And Biden did that, too, with the with the gas prices. Right. I mean, he got up there and said, you guys with your corner gas station, I guess, you know, and also obviously bigger corporate entities, like you're the ones who are doing the bad thing here. Stop it. And, you know, knowing that he had really no legal power to do it, I think gave those business owners the kind of fortitude to resist. It's a little less clear in the case of the social media platforms where the power of the government starts and stops.
I would actually say that if you look at the trajectory of job owning, it's a little bit concerning, because it starts with presidents saying, look, you've got to not raise prices. And then that doesn't work. And so that leads in 1971 to Nixon imposing wage and price controls. And like that was the next step after job owning failed.
I think the big takeaway for me from both the Facebook files and the Twitter files is less about what the government was doing, because as Catherine is right to stress, you know, it wasn't the government was saying, if you don't do this, you're going to get in big trouble or anything like that. It was actually the way in which the social media platforms, which are increasingly oftentimes totally staffed by people who had been in government recently and are going back there at some point, the way that they were calling on the government to give them direct guidance or like, you know, please help us out with this. Or, you know, in the case of the Twitter files, the stuff that was most amazing was the way that the internal communication showed that people were ready to make a decision and then figure out how to justify it later according to the terms of service. You know, what is more likely to be controlled is not the government per se, but these social media platforms and how they respond to their users, either staying there, calling for change, or leaving. And to me, that's the most, kind of disturbing thing, is that this was not, it wasn't like the government pushing on a closed door. Facebook had opened the door and was saying, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? Tell us what to do. What should we be doing? Again, some of that is understandable. You know, they're trying to be a good corporate citizen and everything. But, you know, the problem, I think, in this case is less government and it's more the way these companies are run, oftentimes at odds with what either the founders or even the main executives want out of this stuff.
Nick, I think that's right. I mean, in some ways, right, like the hard thing for libertarians to reckon with here is that these companies are staffed by ex-government employees and people who are quite to the left of the average voter, who believe that government is good and like knows best, and so they seek out this information. It's in many cases, it's not bullying. At the same time, it's not just that President Biden has said that these companies are literally killing people or whatever it is that, you know, the quote exactly was. It's that top White House aides are saying things like, certainly they, as in social media companies, should be held accountable. You've heard this president speak very aggressively about this. He understands that this is an important piece of the ecosystem when asked about Section 230, which is an important liability protection for online companies as well as for individuals. And so there are, if not explicit threats being made towards specific companies, there is certainly open talk about changing the law because the sense is that social media companies are doing wrong.
Catherine, you were butting in there for a second.
Basically, to make the same point, that I really do think the background noise of potential, you know, change in the legal system can't be disregarded here. And that was why I initially made this assignment to Robbie, you know, a few months back, was how do we capture that? How do we think about that? You know, when there are always a couple of bills floating around Congress that threaten to change the legal status of the speech that is happening on these platforms and change the liability that the platforms might bear, it's just not right to say, you know, the problem is the ideology or the culture of these companies alone, because it doesn't exist in a vacuum. And this ultimately is the case for smaller government, right? You can't predict the ways in which just a big, powerful, sort of chaotic state will change behavior. You can't always see the straight lines, but you know it's there. It's this menace that lurks over every corporate decision. And I just think you can't underestimate it.
I agree with that. And I'll just add that, you know, this is also from a libertarian point of view, this is what is important, though, is to understand how power operates. And I think a lot of our discourse, but a lot of other libertarian discourse at the beginning of COVID or even before was like, well, the government is the bad actor. The government is always the bad actor. And what we are finding out more and more, and again, I think that's what these internal documents and this kind of forced transparency is good at, is that it complicates that narrative tremendously. This would be like finding out, you know, that the New York Times or the Washington Post was checking in with the government about the Pentagon Papers or something like that. We have this theory that, you know, media companies, even social media companies, are somehow bulwarks against control of free speech or something like that. And what these things do is they show that the culture of Facebook, the culture of Twitter and things like that actually does matter a lot, because that could be the stopping point against a government attempt, by the government to rewrite laws in a way that really constrain free speech. And again, the other thing is, you know, what social media really needs to do is to come up with a way of being transparent about its decision making in a way that doesn't, you know, fuck up its secret, you know, formula for algorithms and stuff like that, but makes people feel comfortable and secure and confident that they are not, that they're not being shadow banned, that they're not being silenced, that they're not being completely reduced or kicked off platforms for totally arbitrary reasons.
Isn't that just a market opportunity, though, for competitors to provide that as
a
service?
No, not really. I mean, it is, and it isn't. Like Mastodon, I mean, you know, first off, one of the reasons why Facebook and Twitter are popular and Instagram is because they have massive audiences, and also because they promise something like free and equal access to audiences and things like that. You know, I mean, we can talk about decentralization, et cetera, but we already see this at Mastodon. You know, a bunch of the Mastodon, confederated servers and stuff like that, you know, restrict people completely. I mean, there's like certain, you know, they just have like total ban lists on whole other servers on that. So I don't, you know, it's good, it's great. And there are a ton, like the energy, as I think you guys were both saying, has already started moving to more encrypted or smaller scale places that can't be shut down. But that's not going to replace the function of Facebook or Twitter, which is partly to reach a massive centralized audience.
And even those decentralized places can be vulnerable to government pressure, as we saw definitely in the Canadian truckers strike or protest of last February, when the government of Justin Trudeau, whose name I just want to say Pierre every single time, or Maggie, the better Trudeau, went after people who thought that they were conducting their business via the blockchain, or at least through Bitcoin and things like that, and found out the hard way that that money in many cases was not safe. So they'll find ways. They will probe the defenses. One possible observation, knitting together all three of your points of view, is that There's a cultural component here. I'm thinking of, like, why was jawboning created? And of course, I haven't read Peter's feature, and I'm not necessarily soliciting an answer from Peter at this time, but why was jawboning a term that felt like it needed to be created in 1969? Well, because there was a sense that, hey, wait a second, the president is doing something that's a little bit unseemly. Shouldn't be out there, like, putting pressure on individual companies. Imagine that now. Imagine that as a concept. That concept is dead. There is nobody who really, in any organized way, there isn't a cultural taboo, there isn't a governing political cultural taboo against presidents jawboning private companies all the time, now, forever, unless there's a large cultural change. And that's generally true of free speech as well. It's another topic we've been talking about a lot over the last several years on this podcast, is that in many ways, companies that Nick is criticizing and that Peter is rightly pointing out their cultural composition, they could be actually acting like way too many Americans want them to act. Americans are becoming more censorious over time and want to use speech as a weapon, or at least the blocking of access of speech as a weapon. And it's bad. And man, we got to change the culture, just like David Crosby wanted us to. All right, we're going to end that part of that
conversation.
Looks
like the culture changed him, Matt Welch.
All right, man, that's a rabbit hole that's just going to produce so many bad songs. And I recommend people go listen to Nick Gillespie on Political Beats talking about the Birds. From a couple of years back or whatever. All right, we're going to, speaking of Canada, read out our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, friends, you might think you've done everything in your power to insure your family in case of a medical emergency. But what many of us don't realize is that health insurance won't always cover the full cost of, for example, an emergency medical flight. If you require air transport, even comprehensive coverage can leave you with high deductibles and copays. That's where Air Medcare Network comes in. When you sign up to become a member of the Air Medcare Network, should any such emergency arise, you will not see a bill for air medical transport when flown by a provider. Air Medcare transports more than 100,000 patients each and every year. That's about a dozen just during the duration of this podcast. And this peace of mind for you and your whole family can be yours beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. But wait, listeners to the Roundtable can get gift cards with their new memberships for up to $50 through either Visa or Amazon. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason, use the offer code REASON, and start protecting your family. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. There was a funny one that came in the other day of someone saying, why does everyone who sends email have to write an essay? Which is mean, but also a little bit funny. This one is not an essay, and it comes from Sam Kerr, who writes, hi all, longtime listener and super fan of the show from up here in Canada. Enjoy hearing a libertarian perspective that is so absent from 99.5% of our discourse. I appreciate the decimal accuracy there. Does the Roundtable have any thoughts on current Canadian politics, particularly the ascendancy of the kind of libertarian Pierre Poilievre, that's how you do it, to the helm of the Conservative Party to challenge Justin Trudeau? We're currently going through contortions of a ridiculous federal gun ban, a centralizing and patronizing national government, and a populace that can't get enough of experts' say takes. Can a liberty-minded party ever be successful in a country like Canada that leans somewhat towards social democracy and is skeptical of markets? Catherine, what say you?
I must admit to not paying a ton of attention to Canadian politics, but what I do have is immigration policy envy about Canada. Every single time I see anything about the way that Canadians are talking, thinking about immigration policy and trying to shape their policy, I think, like, that makes more sense. I don't often think that about, you know, whatever little tidbit of Canadian politics I'm hearing. For instance, the human rights tribunals that, you know, seem to, like, string people up for casually using the word gypsy. I mean, there's a bunch of crazy stuff happening up there, as far as I can tell. But they, you know, even just Justin Trudeau was out here saying last week or whatever, we're going to dramatically expand quotas for lots of different types of visas. We didn't do this lightly, but Canada needs workers and we think that we can absorb these people into our culture. Like, yeah, please, that. Thank you. Would love to have it. So I guess that is my main contribution, is to the extent that Canada seems to be able to have that conversation, I guess it gives me a little bit of hope for, you know, a more libertarian or kind of more open approach in other areas of their politics as well. But I am far from an expert.
Peter, since Catherine didn't answer the question, I'm going to step on Nick's tie. What can you answer the question?
So if the question is, does the roundtable have any thoughts on current Canadian politics? Yeah,
I did answer the question.
The answer is maybe not so much. I mean, look, there's the reason that like the Michael Kinsley's old joke about the most boring possible headline in journalism is worthwhile Canadian initiative. And like no one is going to read that story. And no one does read that story. Look, I guess what I would say is my read of the situation in Canada is it's not entirely unlike what you just said, Matt, about the public and Facebook and social media companies. To some extent, Canada has the government that its citizens want. And Canadians are just much more okay with deferring to authority and to public health authorities. And there's just much less controversy. There's obviously not none, as the trucker protests, made clear. At the same time, culturally, Canada is just much more sort of okay with like, yeah, the government's going to make decisions and then like you won't be able to do some stuff. And some people will have to do some things that they might not otherwise have done. And like taxes will be higher and most of the, you know, the healthcare system will be run by the government. And that's just how things are going to be. And to the extent that reformers can make a difference, I think it is that it is not going to be primarily on a sort of big ideological sort of case for reforming government. It's going to be on practical initiatives that actually make people's lives better and that can be demonstrated to make people's lives better. And I think that, you know, sort of people like, yes, of course, I am motivated by ideology and sort of a big picture vision of how the world works and how government, you know, should be and how it works best and when it doesn't, you know, how it doesn't work and how it fails. But I think most people, and especially in a place like Canada, are going to be motivated by, does my life feel better now after this law passed or after this person was elected than it did beforehand? And that's the question that people looking to make inroads into Canadian politics should be asking.
Nick, will your answer reference Canadian comedians or rock musicians?
I was going to talk about old Expos players, Matt, although they're almost all from America originally. So it's
including but, Le Grand Orange.
Yes, that's right. Rusty Staub, who ended up playing for so many good teams. Canada, yes. I was checking this out, though. Part of the problem is like, Canada has some obvious issues which come up in the American context. Canada, according to the Heritage Foundation, which would have every reason to put down Canada, Canada is 15th on its index of economic freedom. The U.S. is a lowly 25th. Canada is the best country in the Western Hemisphere for economic freedom. According to the Heritage Foundation, they pioneered national weed legalization. They're great on drugs as well as immigration and a bunch of other stuff. So they had basically a third the number of people per capita die from COVID as the U.S. So, they didn't have the economic crisis that we had in 2008 and things like that. Canada's doing a bunch of stuff right. It is a destination country for a lot of really talented immigrants and people from around the world. This guy, and how do you pronounce his name, though, Matt Welch, the Canadian politician?
I would do it Poilievre.
Okay, very good. He sounds dynamite, though, because he's pro-crypto, he's pro-immigration, he's pro-choice, he's anti-vaccine mandate. I wish he would emigrate to the United States and change the Constitution and become president here. I think that Canada, the wheels are somewhat coming off of their healthcare system, but that has become a point of national pride. He's also against the doctor-assisted suicide law in Canada, which I think is interesting. There's a lot of weird shit going on about that. But as Canada starts to supplement its fully state-owned, no escape healthcare system with market, you know, market informed alternatives. I think this guy has a real possibility. But I mean, what he's going to be doing is taking a Canada from good to great, and that might be harder to do than, you know, a failing country like the United States from bad to, you know, maybe passable. But you know, Canada is not as bad as we like to think when we hold on to one, you know, part of the Canadian moose and say this is the whole thing.
I'm just heartened that a semi-libertarian leaner politician up there has a French surname. It's usually from the Edmonton yep. type of people who come up with that stuff. I would commend people to read our Dynamite, I believe, November 2010 issue, How to Slash the State, mm-hmm. featuring the horrifying fingers of Catherine Mangu Ward.
It's in knife. literally in 3D.
There's a piece there called It Can Happen Here, in which people talk about various case studies that have happened where government spending has actually been reduced in semi-normal countries. And one of those cases was in Canada. And as written by the great David Henderson, who doesn't get enough credit just in general for being a great person and a great public policy commentator.
Well, he is
writer.
From Canada, right? So
yeah, you know. So he's obviously an apologist, but he pointed out in his piece that from 1992 to 2001, Canadian spending on federal programs fell from 17.5% of GDP to 11.3%. They had a budget surplus for more than a decade in a row. When government debt was 68% of GDP, it went down to 29%. And this was done by liberal politicians as much as anyone else. There's some tax increases that were associated with that, but a lot of actual real year-on-year government spending cuts. So it can happen. As ever, I'm more hopeful about libertarian policy aims, individual goals than political parties. So maybe that can happen. There, maybe it can happen here, although these days I don't have a whole lot of faith in that. All right, let's go to our second half of the show topic, which I'm absolutely not filibustering about while I'm clicking
try
up
to
on
remember
my
what it was.
Was it National School Choice Week, my friend?
I just want to make sure that I'm orienting the conversation, Nick, anchoring it correctly. It is National School Choice Week, which does... by virtue of its very good naming, doesn't require any explanation. It's National School Choice Week. It's an annual event. That's what it does. We've been at Reason, have been a co-sponsor of this, a participant in this for a good long time. Catherine, can you explain, as the editrix, the purpose and practical effect of our involvement with the Yellow Scarfers? And then perhaps lead us in a round of personal testimonials about how your education experiences, however interpreted, have shaped your attitudes about, as former Reasoner Corey DeAngelis says 17 times a day, funding students instead of systems.
Yeah, I will strive not to tweet that phrase 17 times a day, although it is a good and important phrase. So, you know, Reason... kind of takes this opportunity every January to do a little cluster of journalism around school choice. Because the thing about it is, this has been a huge victory, right? Like, school choice is a little idea that got hatched out of, you know, Milton Friedman's fevered brain, and that sounded absolutely bananas, specifically the ideas about using vouchers and charters to expand choice for people who are within or adjacent to the public system. And it's really a classic example of, like, that sounds insane until you do it. And then it's just an ordinary part of the fabric of our educational system. But it can be easy to kind of take that victory for granted. And also education stories, you know, they tend to kind of follow a little bit of a template, right? You know, you find a family, you tell their story. And, you know, people on every side of this debate just use stories for their own ends. We are not immune from that. But I think it's good to take a minute and just kind of look at the progress that we've made. I am definitely a person who has benefited from the school choice that that people with money have always had, which is that my kids now go to private school. But but that, you know, COVID really did make people rethink a lot of this. And in particular, that we've moved, you know, a lot of the energy was in the charter school space, and that we're now moving, I think, a little bit more toward variants of vouchers, education savings accounts, that kind of thing. That has long been championed by Reason, was considered a more extreme version, I think, by some people, because it is just taking a chunk of public money and handing it to parents to do what they think best. And that makes a certain type of education bureaucrat nervous, and makes me happy that they're nervous.
Part of that is goosed by the Supreme Court decision last year saying that public money can be used in religious and parochial education. And now we've got school choice, I mean, this week, this month, bills in Florida, Utah, Indiana. There's basically a dozen or so states that are in the process of thinking about it, in addition to Arizona and West Virginia, who have already done it. Nick, can you give us some reflections of your long work in this category, but also perhaps even your personal experiences and how it shapes the way that you look at it?
Well, I am a victim of school choice. My parents exercised what, in retrospect, is just a really bad decision. I grew up in Middletown, New Jersey, where at the time the teachers had the highest average pay in all of New Jersey, which is recently ranked, I think, by Heritage again as the worst state for school choice in the country. But my parents chose to put me into a mediocre parochial school system, and that actually stuck me with the bill for my last year of high school. So they, you know, I don't know what my parents were doing, but I celebrate their ability to control my education. If only I had gone to a different, if only I had gone to better funded, more academically rigorous public schools, I probably wouldn't be talking to you guys right now. And so, you know, I'm thinking a lot about this during school choice week. Eight states have ESAs, which, as Catherine was saying, is really kind of where the action is. And this generally what it does is it takes the state contribution to a kid's school, to a kid's education, and gives it to the parents to go to a public school, to a private school, to tutoring service, to pretty much, depending on how the law is written, to anything the parents say is an educational kind of enterprise or undertaking, also homeschooling and things like that. It's pretty fascinating. Arizona just passed a big law. Florida has one. Later this week, the Reason Interview podcast on Wednesday is with Lieutenant Governor of Virginia, Winsome Sears, who this is her pet issue. She was on the Virginia Board, State Board of Education, and she has introduced legislation to create ESAs that would give, you know, people between about $4,000 to $6,000 to spend directly on their kids' education the way they want. I think it's great. It's all long overdue. What is interesting is that I think it's important to understand that an increase in school choice, and right now about three quarters of K through 12 students go to traditional assigned public schools. A bunch go to school public schools of choice, including charters and magnets and things like that. About 10% go to private schools. But when we have universal school choice, this will be like when we have universal choice in religion. It will not mean all of the conversation will go away. It will just mean there will be many more interesting and diverse conversations that will inflame the passions and whatnot, but people will be able to actually, you know, live the vision of education they want for their kids. The kids will also have a say in this. So it's all to the good, and it's one of the most exciting pushbacks against kind of Leviathan over the past, in the post-war era. We took the number of school districts from over 100,000 to about 12,000. I mean, there's just been massive centralization in K through 12 education over the past century, and that's starting to break up. And I think people who are interested in decentralization and individual control and experimentation should be very excited by school choice.
I will say also that the kind of shift in the debate about school choice has also just moved the focus of those who would control education. And I think that's kind of, you know, looking ahead to the next 5 or 10 years, that's what I think Reason is going to be covering is, you know, curriculum wars, you know, the sort of need to increasingly specify from a high level of government what can and can't be taught in schools that receive government money, because, of course, that's the famous way that you get your thin end of your wedge into private institutions, as we've talked about in many, many areas. And also, you know, to the extent that charters need to receive a charter and have that charter renewed, or that vouchers will need to go to a approved list of schools, the fight's just going to shift there. So I, you know, I do think school choice is a good thing, and, you know, sometimes a literally a life-saving thing for some kids. But I also worry about, you know, it's authoritarians all the way down. And so there's just always going to be a new place to fight about who controls the contents and kind of mode of education, and that we're in a moment where that the location of that fight is shifting, and that's worth keeping an eye on.
Catherine, even as you're saying that, it occurs to me, you know, there's been the Democratic Party on national level in 10 years has really flipped on charter schools in particular. Back then, Barack Obama's Race to the Top was about, you know, it's a smallish program, but it was trying to incentivize school districts to be innovative in producing new kinds of schools of choice. And now it is a litmus test where if you have any pretense of running for president or some important thing, you have to be vociferously against charters. Bill de Blasio, former mayor of New York and a really dynamite candidate for president. He's
of Canada.
Dude, like, tried to run for Congress in my district or nearby and for a hot minute, and like was in fifth place or something, and then dropped out. It's amazing. But anyways, he went in front of a bunch of Democratic presidential aspirants in 2019, went in front of a big education teachers union conference, and he pronounced that he hated charter schools. And in New York State, where I live, and this is all approved at the state level, there's been a pretty strong enforcement on a cap of the number of charter schools. And just by doing that in Democratic polities and the huge shift that has in Democratic things, I think that is pushing more people away from any kind of publicly funded system. Like that exercise of control is just pushing more people out. It's a kind of a classic consequences unintended and otherwise. Peter, do you want to reflect on your yellow scarf and your personal experiences that make you treasure it, or in Nick's case, hate it?
Sure, I love scarves. Kind of winter weather in general. Give me a sweater and a scarf of any color and I'm happy. And that's what school choice is really about. Good scarves.
The swag. Yeah. I mean, I will say, as a branding campaign, you know, National School Choice Week, they have this very bright yellow color. They distribute scarves and signs, and they learn a little dance. There's a little dancing part to it.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It's like a little North Korean. It's like the doll in Megan.
Yeah.
No, look, the premise of conventional public education is that one size fits all, that basically every kid in a defined geographic area should have something like the same experience with something like the same curriculum. And I went to a public school, and I can tell you, one size does not fit all. My experience was not entirely bad, but so much of it was just a huge, obvious waste of my time. And I made that argument at the time, and it was true, and I didn't learn anything from many, many, many of my classes. Now, partly that was because I intentionally set out not to learn anything. I just didn't pay attention. I read books that I wanted to read and wrote things that I wanted to write and sort of wasn't particularly involved with it. But the stuff that I was being sort of tasked with learning, in particular, the sort of core educational requirements of the state of Florida in the mid-1990s, it's just a bunch of obvious nonsense, especially for someone who had very clear interests and abilities. And so the parts of school that were good were, for the most part, the parts that I got to choose, in particular, the band and acting programs, the extracurriculars, though they were, you know, part of my daily school day. I had an hour of band every day, and then I had an hour in an acting class my junior and senior years. And those were the parts where I actually learned something, in part because I was invested in those things, because I had chosen these were the classes that I thought were important and interesting, and I wanted to succeed in them. And so I think this is like so much of, you know, school choice we talk about, you know, oh, this is better for families where they get to sort of pick their, like, it's just better for students when students who are not necessarily motivated by a traditional, conventional sort of here's your sort of core courses education, when those students get to pick the things that they want to do and are actually personally invested in it. And so I think we can do a lot more to motivate kids who are not necessarily doing super well at school. And I say that as someone who was not a great student in high school. If I'd had more opportunity to be involved in picking and sort of and sorting through what I got out of school, then I feel, I mean, in my experience, the parts that I was involved in were the parts that I was just much better at and that I got a lot more from and that I succeeded at.
Matt, if I may, other video products that are coming up for National School Choice Week or School Choice Week. We've got a video that I did with Justin Zuckerman about three great fictional schools that we all wanted to attend, which gets to some of what Peter is talking about. And it is kind of fascinating. I've long been amazed at this, you know, that we take for granted that school is a version of prison or Orwell's 1984 that you suffer through. And then instead of like doing it different for your kids, you kind of like replicate that system, you know, which is not serving people particularly well. You mentioned New York State, Matt. Last year for School Choice Week, we did a video about based on Reason Foundation report. New York State spends on average $30,000 a year per student, and their kids are so far below competency in reading. It is astonishing. Like, there is no way you couldn't give every fucking kid in New York $30,000 and tell them to be reading at a, you know, at a senior and high school level at the end of that year, even if they're 4 years old. But schools get 12 whacks at that and fail. But then we also have a great live stream, Zach Weismuller and I, on Thursday with Robert Pondicio, who is an education analyst at the American Enterprise Institute, as well as the Fordham Institute, actually taught in the South Bronx in really tough schools. And he is an absolute champion of school choice, but is also a critic of the way that most schools of choice are run. That's going to be an electrifying conversation on Thursday.
Just building on what you just said, Nick, strikes me just about like the pattern following and also the $30,000. Our family's in a similar situation of Catherine, where because of pandemic and other things, pulled at least one of our two kids, it's unclear about the second, out of the public system and put it in the private system, And it costs less than those $30,000, as a matter of fact. And we reflect constantly about how much better that place is. It's incredible how much better that place is than what we pulled her from a school that is widely considered one of the best in New York City in the public system. And it's just remarkably better. And it makes me think about the kind of pattern of behavior, Nick, that like there's some Stockholm syndrome associated with this. Like one of the breed of libertarian that annoys me the most. And if we can just go ahead and start going down this path, how much time we got?
Yeah. Pick this bike. Let's do it.
What is the one pruned thicket? That be
the one. You know, if you talk about, if you criticize the way that the public school system works in New York City, they'll either say serves you right for going to government schools, or serves you right for living in New York City. And these are the types of people who, I predict, don't have great social skills, just evidenced by their social skills. But also that they kind of have a point in the sense, only in the sense, not in interpersonally, but in the way that everyone's brains are just kind of hardwired by having gone through it of like, that's normal. This is normal. I went to magnet school, you know, a blue ribbon school in Long Beach, California. And there's a little program within it. And I think there's a little cluster of me and a couple of other kids who, because everyone's dad was an aerospace engineer, everyone was really good at math. And they ran out of math to teach us by the time we were in third grade in a K through six. And so because of that, we either threatened or executed, I don't know, I wasn't really in charge of it, like at least two different lawsuits against the against the city. We became pariahs within the schools that we went to, especially in junior high school. Teachers treated us like crap. It was this long, drawn out thing that at the end of it made me hate math, which is something that I grew up loving in all of this. And what do I do when we have kids? Granted, my wife is French and goes through, and they have a pretty generally excellent public sector and school system compared to America's. We're like, oh, definitely have to send our kids to public schools. That's like, it's really important not to like go to some, you know, artsy fartsy airy fairy type of private system. You know, you got to go through the public thing. It's like, what is that? And so now I'm feeling a sense of guilt that our oldest kid has been through the public school system this whole time. So it makes me want everybody else, like Catherine, to have the opportunity to enjoy what we have enjoyed. Give them the money, let them choose, and they can have these great reflections on a daily or weekly basis, if it works out well, that they feel like they're getting a better bang for their buck than funding the systems instead of the students. And that's the memo. All right, let's go to our end of podcast. What we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I read Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh. It's pretty good. A novel from the 1940s. There's some good sentences in it.
Yeah.
It's a great book about that's like as understated as I can be. Some shockingly spectacular sentence work on almost every page that just kind of blew me away for 400 pages or so. And it's a great novel about middle age and life and regret and love and forgiveness and the existence of God and faith and war and, you know, getting older. And there's a great little bit about education, since we're talking about that. So I was really tempted to just bring in a long list of quotes to read, but I will just read one here. The trouble with modern education is you never know how ignorant people are. With anyone over 50, you can be fairly confident what's been taught and what's been left out. But these young people have such an intelligent, knowledgeable surface, and then the crust suddenly breaks and you look down into depths of confusion you didn't know existed. It's a good book, folks. It's a good book.
I am so interested to see what it looks like when a man in his 40s makes Brideshead Revisited his whole personality, since I knew lots and lots of people in college who, you know, were in their 20s and made Brideshead Revisited their whole personality. I think it's going to look pretty different, and I'm excited to see how that goes.
I'm glad that you brought that up and recommended that, Peter, because I've always judged that book by its title and thought, costume drama enough.
No.
Enough Merchant Ivory.
It starts out with a 39-year-old divorced guy like looking back on his life and comparing his time in the army to a marriage that is obviously ending but has not yet ended, and sort of the deadness of it all and just sort of the going through the motions of it. And then he goes back to his college life and starts to look back on his friendships and his connections with this one sort of family. And it's very sort of aristocratic British conservative nostalgic, right? Like, this is not a libertarian book in a lot of ways, right? It is just sort of about the British upper crust and sort of what was lost in the early part of the 20th century. At the same time, its vision of a good life is incredibly compelling, and the artistry behind the creation of the thing, the object itself, sentence by sentence, it's so immaculate and so perfect that I just sort of, I couldn't help but fall for its vision of the world, even if it's not one I fully agree with.
Put a quick word in for the Jeremy Irons Brideshead Revisited thing, which is clogging up the internet somewhere. But I read Collaborate, How to Build Incredible Collaborative Relationships at Work, Even If You'd Rather Work Alone, by Deborah Mashick, who's a research social psychologist. Who was the first executive director of Heterodox Academy and is now a consultant. This is a wonderful book that's out tomorrow. I know Deb, I consider her a friend, but for all of us who live in a distributed workforce and have to work with other people, I highly recommend reading Collaborate. Not crazy about that title, but it's a very good substantive book about how to work well with people, because we all have to. And part of what she's talking about here is that we have to work more and more with other people, no matter what your job is, but we do it at a remove, so that the older forms of kind of collaborating in person have given way to kind of asynchronous kind of communication and collaboration, which makes it so much more difficult to do that, because Slack, email, even Zoom calls and things like that are just relentlessly flat media through which to, you know, kind of get shit done. So I recommend Collaborate by Deb Mashick.
Catherine, you held your tongue remarkably during that little presentation. What have you been consuming?
I was so brave, Matt. Thank you for giving me a cookie. I read, like Peter, for some reason, I sort of dipped back into the classics. I read Sulla by Toni Morrison. It's her second book. It was published in 1973. And I read it in high school. I was assigned it in high school. Took absolutely nothing away from it. Speaking of education where you just waste your time because you're not the right person for that curriculum in that moment. Reread it just now and was blown away by the sort of intensity and beauty of this book. It's basically like Alana Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend, but make it Ohio. It's just this very, very concise book. It's about 170 pages and yet manages to be an intergenerational saga about, you know, the economic fate of a town and female friendship and love and family and violence and murder. And there's so much in these pages that it makes me want to like take this book to the authors of other intergenerational sagas and be like, do this. You don't need 800 pages. Toni Morrison didn't need 800 pages. Like, here, be like Toni. It just was really, really good, really dark, very, very depressing. And part of my reading of it really made me reflect on how 10th grade me had no capacity to grapple with this book, but it was on the list. And so we read it. I will say that this book is now on banned book lists, right? This is one of the books that has joined other works by Toni Morrison, because it does have very, very dark themes and also has to do with race. And so there's that. You know, the fact that it goes from mandatory to banned and back again speaks to, at the very least, the fact that maybe we shouldn't have a central repository for that sort of thing. You know, I really, really recommend it. If you think you know how you feel about Toni Morrison because someone made you read it in high school, this, I think, is a good book to try again. There's also a wonderful foreword, at least in my edition. I'm generally anti-foreword. I am team skip the foreword. But this one talks about how she struggled with, you know, the fact that people expect Black authors to be political. And then she wrote this book that was not political. And then everyone reviewed it politically. And how disappointing that was. It really sets the tone to read the book, I think, in the right mindset. And so if you can get the edition that has kind of the green cover with the swoopy gold lettering that has this foreword in it, I would say go for that one in particular.
I also strongly recommend the foreword by Waugh to Brideshead Revisited, where he talks about having written this in the wake of World War II deprivations and shortages. And that is, he sort of blames the book's gustatory lust for life, which is part of the pleasure of this book, is that there is so much food and drink and drink and drink and drink described in this book so well that, and in part, he says it's because it was written coming out of World War II's shortages and the inability to have things. And it's a wonderful book about sort of about small physical pleasures, especially those that you can consume.
I yesterday did not read a book, either new or ancient. But rather, I had a couple hours to kill in Englewood, New Jersey, So let's talk about my life choices that got me to that moment. And so like, all right, what am I going to do? Let's go visit that thing I've always driven by and heard about in New York City. And never went there because it has a weird name. The Cloisters.
Oh, yeah.
The Cloisters, people.
Oh, my God. Matt, you're becoming so Catholic. It's killing me.
I'm not becoming Catholic. I'm becoming objectively pro, really cool art and random places that don't make any sense, even after you've had it explained to you. So this is at the absolute top of the needle of Manhattan. It's on a hilltop overlooking where the Hudson and Harlem rivers conflue. And it's this place that, so some dude was a collector of medieval religious artifacts and art. I'm sure he stole stuff too, who knows? And he had a place in Manhattan, his rich guy, and he called it the Cloisters. And then he was getting old, or maybe he died. And my history is really good. And then John D. Rockefeller came in and said, hey, let's, you know, we should make this into like a public museum. Let's gather that stuff, collect more like it, and let's build a place that looks like a monastery up on a hilltop above New York City and put it all in there and put all other types of weird art, you know, from kind of the 12th century up to the 16th or 17th century. And it's just really a spectacular setting, and the level of like the wood carving detail. If anyone follows me on Instagram, I have a couple of spreads on the art in there. It's really remarkable. It's great. It's, you know, I've been to a lot of churches in Europe because that's what you do when you're in Europe and you're an American. Let's go to the church. And man, there's a few places that I've seen that have such a concentration of great stuff. They have a unicorn room with unicorn tapestries, which is apparently the most famous part of the place, which why not? And just a bunch of great, weird stuff. The place just kind of does. And it's operated by the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So here's a fake monastery up on a hill built in the 30s by John D. Rockefeller to host medieval European French art. And it's operated by the Metropolitan Museum of Art. That's just like New York in some kind of bizarre nutshell. So add that to your you know, short list of things that you do when you visit New York. I would say go visit there. It must be really spectacular in the spring too, and it's not all cold and frigid up there. You can walk around the adjacent park and enjoy the terraces more. But super great. Cloisters. Check it out. You'll be glad you did. All right. Thank you for listening. Listen next week too, because we do this every week on Monday. You can, we have a snickering sub portal on our site, reason.com/snickering. And check out our stuff there, but also our podcast, reason.com podcasts. If you like what we do as an organization, reason.com/donate. And we'll catch you back next Monday. Thank you. Good night.